Hey everybody, welcome to Morbidology. Before we get started, I'd like to take a second to thank my new Patreon supporters, Kristen Lyons, John Mickelson, Helen Bryden, Joanne Post, Olivia Dunbar, Sammy, Max DeVries, Andy Hess, and Cynthia Akey. I am eternally grateful for your support. You can support the show on Patreon for as little as $1 a month. There's some cool extras up on there, like bonus episodes of Morbidology Plus, ad-free episodes, true crime articles, polls, and you can even request a case for me to cover on the podcast. The support on Patreon goes such a long way in making Morbidology what it is. I'd also like to say that I have an amazing giveaway up on Instagram for a Plus Pass ticket to Podcast Movement's live event. Just head to instagram.com/morbidologyofficial for a chance to win. And before I forget, I'm going to CrimeCon in London next year, and I would love to see you there. Head to crimecon.co.uk and enter promo code MORBID for 10% off your ticket. Next up is a quick word from this week's sponsor, and then on with the show. Forever Has Fallen is a new podcast thriller that has lit up social media. There's a bunch of people now thinking digital immortality is real and available now. This shows you how detailed and well-produced Forever Has Fallen is. You have an amazing story about a tech billionaire on the run, and if you want more, you can participate in the action by becoming a bounty hunter. It's like a network of digital escape rooms for you to play with friends. So check out foreverhasfallen.com or click the link in my show notes. Listen on all major podcast platforms and sign up as a bounty hunter. I promise you, you'll have never seen anything quite like it. Welcome to Morbidology, the podcast. I'm your host, Emily G. Thompson, author of Unsolved Child Murders, Cults Uncovered, and co-author of Unsolved Murders, True Crime Cases Uncovered. Join me weekly as I uncover some of the world's most heinous murders. Police officers put themselves at risk each day, and collateral damage can be a reality that they deal with on a day-to-day basis. While police officers are frequently killed in the line of duty, it's very rare that a police officer is killed by one of their own. What started out as a routine 911 report ended with a police officer bleeding on the ground and another one holding the weapon. One-year-old Eric Chapnik was a married father of four who immigrated from Poland to Ottawa, Canada in 1990. Eric had been inspired by his father to join the police. His father had worked on Poland's police force in Warsaw for 30 years. When Eric was 19 years old, he first of all joined the Polish army, but it wasn't for him. After finishing the mandatory single year of service, he left the army and went to work as a mechanic with Warsaw Aircraft Enterprise. He worked here for 7 years before travelling to Greece and working for 2 years as a construction worker. When Eric turned 32, he decided to move to Ottawa, Canada, where he first of all had a career in retail before following his dreams of becoming a police officer. He joined the force later in his life, in his 40s, and was one of the eldest members. At the time, Charles Momey was the president of the Ottawa Police Association. On Eric's graduation day, he met Charles, who recollected.
He did impress upon me the first day that I met him. And I'm not sure why, I can't put my finger on it, but there was something about that individual that just sort of attracted me to him amongst the maybe 20 or 25 that had been hired at the time.
Eric was known for his pleasant demeanor as he patrolled the city's East Division. His colleagues all said that he had pride in his work and described him as a gentle giant. They said that his massive smile, friendly attitude, accent and height would ensure that anybody who ever met him could not forget him. Eric and his wife, Anna, and their children were very active in the local Polish community. They attended Polish-centric parties and events and attended the St. Hyacinth Church. As Anna said, Eric was a very, very good man, and she considered herself extremely lucky to have such a hardworking man who wanted to provide the best, not only for his family, but for his community. Eric absolutely doted on his children, and each year he would dress up as Santa. Eric and Anna were the perfect mix. She did all of the cooking while he did all of the cleaning. In addition to being a family man, Eric was a fantastic friend. If anybody ever needed help with renovations or repairs, Eric was always on hand to help in any way possible.
Hardworking. He was a little bit of a perfectionist, not in a very bad way, but sometimes it could get annoying. But he was, first of all, very Polish. He cherished his roots. And second of all, he was a father and then a police officer, I would say, in that order. At a certain point in his life, he became, in his mid-40s, he became comfortable with English, with being in Canada, being part of Ottawa and the community. And he basically one day told me completely out of the blue that he always wanted to be a police officer, and that was his dream. And me hesitating a little bit, frankly, I don't think realistically I thought that it will happen, but I encouraged him. I said, if this is your dream, try it out. And that's what he did. And he's proven me wrong, and he became a police officer.
It was around 4:30 a.m. on the 29th of December, 2009, when Eric was sitting in his car in a parking bay outside Ottawa's hospital's emergency entrance. It was a dark night, and Eric had been protecting himself from the cold inside the warmth of his car. Shortly after his shift had begun at 9 p.m., he had responded to a call from a woman at the Metcalf Arena at the city's rural southeast edge. When Eric met the woman, she described how she'd been sexually assaulted by a teenage boy who had beat her and bound her with wires that he had cut from the library's phones. Eric had spent most of the night investigating the attack before finding himself parked outside Ottawa Hospital, writing up his notes. It was here that a man approached his vehicle and stabbed him in the neck. The man was overpowered by four paramedics who witnessed the attack. Once the man was subdued, they provided first aid to Eric. Eric was rushed into the hospital, which was just a stone's throw away, but he was pronounced dead around an hour later. It was the first time that an Ottawa police officer had been killed in the line of duty since 1983, when Constable David Upman was shot at a shopping centre during an altercation. Eric's killer was identified as 43-year-old Kevin Gregson, a former member of the RCMP. He was charged with first-degree murder, robbery, and using an imitation firearm in the commission of an offence. Following the murder, many were left wondering if there was some kind of bad blood between Eric and Kevin, and whether or not they had even known each other. As it would turn out, they had never met one another. In 2006, while Kevin was still an RCMP officer, he pulled a knife on Robert Howie, a bishop in the Church of Jesus Christ of the Latter-day Saints in Regina. Kevin had been off duty at the time, but had become angry when Robert had refused to grant him a special card that allows members to enter Mormon temples for certain ceremonies. In fact, Kevin had these privileges earlier, but they had been revoked by the church. He placed the knife down on the table with the blade pointing towards Robert and stated, "You don't know how many ways I've been taught to kill." He bragged that using a knife was much better than using a gun, stating, "I can take someone out much faster with this than any other way." Robert had been overcome with fear, but using his quick wit, he decided to try and talk Kevin down and succeeded. Kevin said, "I'm messed up. Nobody knows how messed up I am." He received a conditional discharge after he pleaded guilty to uttering a death threat and was placed on probation for 18 months. He was suspended without pay pending an appeal of his dismissal from the force. Several months later, Kevin had what he described as cysts on the brain and underwent surgery to have them removed and then had a shunt placed in his head. Before this event, Kevin had been a decorated RCMP officer. In 1998, he graduated from the RCMP training facility in Regina and spent the first few years in the force at the detachment of Pelly, which was a village of around 300 people. In February of 2000, he was praised after saving a suicidal man. He walked towards the man who was brandishing a rifle outside his home as the man shouted at Kevin to kill him. Kevin, who was a rookie police officer at the time, spent the next 45 minutes talking down the suicidal man, earning him a bravery commendation from the province. Speaking to the Salt Star afterwards, he said, "We were trained technically to draw our weapons, but I don't feel like I should because he was so volatile." Following Eric's murder, Police Chief Fern White held a media briefing during which he confirmed that there was no interaction between Eric and Kevin before Kevin launched the attack.
He was a proud officer following in the footsteps of his father, who was also an officer for over 30 years in his home country of Poland.
He thanked the paramedics who wrestled Kevin to the ground, stating, "Without their assistance, I am not sure what would have happened. They used our training to apprehend a suspect who was very difficult to apprehend." He additionally said that their actions had very likely prevented more bloodshed. When the attack had unfolded, Kevin had raised his hand with the bloody knife in a motion to stab one of the paramedics. Thankfully, he had been saved by the female paramedic, who managed to grab his arm and prevent him from thrusting the knife down. Their bravery truly did prevent more deaths. The police force took comfort in the outpouring of support from the community that followed. People from across the state were sending emails and messages of condolences, as well as leaving flowers outside the police headquarters and the hospital, where flags were flying at half-mast. The murder completely stunned the city and left a massive hole in the hearts of Eric's colleagues. A police officer who didn't want to be named said, "It's like a family, a brotherhood, and to know that it's one of our own who perpetrated this makes it tough." Standing shoulder to shoulder, they all gathered outside the hospital. Steve Boucher, president of the Ottawa Police Association, described how he had never received a phone call like the one he received after Eric's murder. He stated, "I think my heart came out through my throat. And then when I showed up at the hospital to see everyone here, to see everybody's faces at the devastation, it tore me apart." The following day, Kevin appeared in court where he was ordered to be placed on suicide watch and ordered not to contact five potential witnesses, including his former and current wife and two of his children. Kevin had his eyes fixed to the floor throughout the court hearing and didn't look up once, not to the judge and not to his elderly parents who were huddled together in the courtroom. The emotion was evident on their faces. His father wept several times. The order for Kevin to be placed on suicide watch had come from some comments that he had made during his interrogation with investigators. He was additionally placed in protective custody. During the court hearing, it was also revealed that shortly before committing the murder, Kevin had stolen a car. It was around 10 p.m. when police received a 911 call from a group of teenagers from Tim Hortons on Greenbank Road. They said that a man had pulled out what appeared to be a black handgun. He then jumped into their silver four-door Honda Civic and fled north on Greenbank Road. Following Eric's murder, the car was discovered parked and running outside the emergency room where the murder had taken place. Following the court hearing, blue ribbons were shared on vehicles throughout the city in honour of Eric. Taxi services and bus services handed out free blue ribbons for those who wanted to attach it to their vehicle. Then on the 4th of January, St. Hyacinth Church on Lebreton Street held a Polish language memorial service in Eric's honour. Around 300 people packed into the small church. A number of people in attendance didn't personally know Eric, but they wanted to attend because of the cultural bond they had with him. One man, Sebastian Sajkowicz, said that he wanted to pay his respects because Eric was Polish, like him, and that he served the community. The following day, there was a visitation at Beechwood Cemetery. Groups of police officers filed into the cemetery to remember their comrade. Inside the building, a police officer directed mourners to the viewing room where Eric lay in an open casket, wearing his uniform. To the left of the casket was a large photograph of Eric, and beside that, there was a coffee table with tissues and bottled water. Eric's widow, Anna, said that she was very grateful for the outpouring of support. The funeral followed the viewing. It was held at the Civic Centre, which held 8,500 seats. The Coliseum building on the north side of the Civic Centre set up a video link with 1,500 seats available to the public.
The funeral got underway just after 2 p.m. before an estimated 8,000 people. They came from all across the country to honour slain Ottawa police officer Constable Eric Chapnick. The first half of the service was a series of powerful and moving eulogies.
Over 4,000 police officers, paramedics and firefighters showed up to pay their respects alongside thousands of civilians. Officers followed Eric's casket along Bank Street to the heart of downtown Ottawa, where his funeral was held. Eric's casket lay at the centre of the floor with a single spotlight illuminating it. Chief Vern White told the mourners, "First Class Constable Chapnick is a hero." He said that when he first met Eric, he had never met anybody who wanted to join the police so badly.
Eric, at 48, was the oldest recruit in the history of the Ottawa Police Service. In 2007, the recruiting officer was challenged as to why we were hiring a 48-year-old man. The response, "I've never seen someone want something so much. I know that he will give his best." And he did.
Friends and family recounted their fond memories of Eric and described him as a humble man as well as a dedicated police officer and devoted husband and wife. His stepson, Lucas Galaska, said that his father never acted to put himself ahead or push his own agenda. He told the mourners, "The man who wore badge 1907 was unselfish. He devoted himself to others and walked the ever so narrow path of righteousness. That's what made him a hero. You have raised the bar for us all, and we will not disappoint you."
Growing up and watching him with my siblings, brother, my sister, not my baby brother, and seeing all the changes he has gone through the years, without any words ever needing to be spoken, I have learned what kind of a father I want to be.
At a reception after the funeral, Anna spoke of her appreciation for the support. She said, "You meant so much to Eric, and you've touched our hearts with kindness and caring. Eric was a proud and dedicated police officer. He loved his job and being part of the policing family. He would be deeply honoured by your tribute to him and the assistance you've provided to us." With the funeral over, it was announced that the force would be looking into whether Eric's murder could have been prevented. Steve Boucher, president of the Ottawa Police Association, said that somewhere along the way, something went wrong, and they needed to ascertain what it was and whether or not it was preventable. It was known that Kevin had been suspended because the RCMP believed that he was unstable. They wanted to look into what exactly was done and whether more could have been done. It was additionally announced that Kevin had randomly fired his attorney, which derailed plans for the preliminary hearing, which had been scheduled for October. Kevin had failed to give a reason why he fired attorney Genscher. He subsequently appeared in court, where it was announced that his family had contacted local lawyer Geraldine Castle Trudel. A judge then ordered a 30-day psychiatric assessment of Kevin at the request of his new lawyer. Attorney Castle Trudel said that the assessment may even take longer than 30 days because of Kevin's complex history, which included being cared for by a neurologist and having a shunt placed in his brain. She revealed that Kevin had a long history of both medical and emotional problems and said that this needed to be fully examined to determine whether it had any effect on his behaviour. The following month, the 30-day psychiatric assessment was extended by another 30 days. There was an unexpected update in the case shortly thereafter when it was announced that Kevin would receive an additional charge of sexual assault and child pornography. The sexual assault charge related to an event which took place just days before Kevin stabbed Eric. He had been accused of sexually assaulting a child. According to attorney Castle Trudel, Kevin staunchly denied the new charges. Meanwhile, a psychiatrist determined that Kevin was not so mentally ill that he could be found not criminally responsible if convicted of the murder. Attorney Castle Trudel said that she would be seeking a second opinion. In September, a memorial plaque for Eric was unveiled at the Elgin Street Police Headquarters. The plaque consisted of a portrait of Eric, his badge number, and a brief description of his final act as a police officer. Anna briefly spoke and told the officers in attendance that the family thanked them for their dedication and said how much the family missed him. The memorial wall in the headquarters was a lasting tribute for the officers who had died during duty. Weeks later, the paramedics who wrestled Kevin to the ground and tried to save the life of Eric were recognized for their bravery. The Association of Municipal Emergency Medical Services of Ontario presented the N.H. McNally Award for Bravery to Craig McInnes, Patricia St. Dennis, Amanda Wallowick, and Virginia Warner. Paramedic Chief Anthony DeMonte commended his staff, stating, "I can't imagine a more deserving group of professionals. Under the most trying of circumstances, they put the health of their patient ahead of their own personal safety. They are a shining example for us all." Kevin appeared in court in mid-October, where it was announced that the case had been delayed. Attorney Castle Trudel had a conflicting schedule, but it was discovered during the court appearance that she hadn't actually informed Kevin. When informed by the judge, Kevin said, "No, she didn't tell me that." The judge later ordered that there was enough evidence against Kevin to send him to trial. He was ordered to appear in court again on the 12th of November for a trial date to be scheduled. There was another setback when Attorney Castle Trudel removed herself from the murder case. There had been a publication ban at the time, so the reason behind her quitting was not known. While the case was pushed back, it was announced that Kevin would be standing trial for Eric's murder in February of 2012 and standing trial on the child sex charges in September of 2012. He would be represented by Toronto-based lawyer Craig Fleming in both cases. On the 29th of February 2012, the murder trial began. It was immediately revealed that just hours after the murder, Eric had confessed to investigators that he had murdered Eric. In a statement of agreed-upon facts, both the Crown and the defence acknowledged that Kevin had committed the murder. That wasn't going to be up for debate during the trial. Up until now, very little was known about the murder due to the publication ban, but that would quickly change. During opening statements, Assistant Crown Attorney Megan Cunningham described how in the early morning hours of the 29th of December 2009, Kevin went to the hospital dressed for battle. He was wearing two bulletproof vests and was carrying two knives and handcuffs. As she explained, he had gone to the hospital with one motivation in mind, to get a gun from a police officer. She told the jury, he had a plan. He'd made a plan to get a gun, and it was his selfish and callous decisions that put him in a crash course that ended tragically in the end of someone's life. Kevin decided he wanted to get a gun, and he decided to get it from a police officer. She said that Eric was simply in the wrong place at the wrong time. She further described how after being stabbed, Eric had struggled his way 30 or 40 feet into the emergency room, leaving a trail of blood behind him. Tragically, the wounds to his neck were so severe that he could not be saved. Turning to the jury, Assistant Crown Attorney Cunningham said that the evidence would be presented during the trial about who Kevin was and what drove him to commit the senseless murder. She said that just days before killing Eric, Kevin's wife had left him, taking their child with her. Furthermore, his career as an RCMP officer was over. The first witness to be called to the stand was Constable Reinhard Lechletner, who had worked alongside Eric. He told the jury that shortly before Eric's murder, he had seen him outside the hospital in his patrol vehicle writing up a report. Shortly thereafter, Constable Reinhard was called to the emergency room where somebody had been stabbed. He entered the room and saw the medical staff doing CPR impressions on somebody. As he got closer, he realized that the person was Eric. He told the jury he was lying motionless, no movement, no blinking. It was very shocking, especially the first time seeing it, with no advance warning. After standing there for a while, he was informed that the assailant was still at the hospital. He went outside and saw Kevin sitting in the back of a police car. He recollected how Kevin had no emotion on his face. With Christmas fast approaching, I'm sure that I'm not the only one already thinking about presents. 2020 has been a strange year, to say the very least, and I know that I want Christmas to be extra special this year. So how about, instead of getting the same run-of-the-mill presents for your loved ones, why not get them something amazing and unique? WYLD Gallery has the perfect solution. This gallery features fine art by Native American artists. The art is bright, bold, and pop style, and some paintings even have a little historical tension thrown in. All of their paintings explore heritage, culture, and tradition, and a number of their artists have art featured in the permanent collections of a number of museums, including the Smithsonian National Museum of the American Indian in Washington, D.C. and New York City. What's amazing about this gallery is that it's all available online. There's no need to venture out to the shops. Just head on over to wyld.gallery or click the link in my show notes to have a look at some of the cool paintings that they have for sale. Not only are you getting a gorgeous painting for your loved one, or even for yourself, but you're supporting Native American artists. His testimony was followed by paramedic Craig McInnes, who had pulled Kevin off Eric. Craig told the jury that he and three other paramedics had noticed the police car outside and decided to go out and investigate. As they got closer, they noticed Eric on the ground with Kevin on top of him. Thinking back to that night, Eric said, "It's difficult to describe. He was making short little punches. The assailant was on top of him, crouched, knee on either side of his chest. Craig managed to grab Kevin and put him in a headlock to try and get him off Eric, and they both fell to the ground. After subduing him momentarily, Craig asked Kevin why, and Kevin replied, "It didn't have to be like this. All he had to do was give me his gun, and none of this would have ever happened." Craig responded by telling Kevin that an officer never gives up his gun. Out of the corner of her eye, paramedic Patricia Walkowiak noticed that Kevin still had a knife and he was about to thrust it down on Craig. Patricia managed to slam her foot down on Kevin's wrist and get the knife out of his hand. The third paramedic, Patricia St. Denis, managed to jump on top of Kevin, and all three managed to handcuff him with Eric's own handcuffs. Kevin laughed and said, "You're not very good at your job, are you?" To which Craig replied, "You're an idiot. We are paramedics, not cops." Eric had managed to get himself up off the ground after the attack, but he was apprehensive about leaving the paramedics alone with Kevin. Craig described how Eric stood there as copious amounts of blood poured from the deep wounds on his neck. Craig shouted at him to get into the emergency room, but Eric didn't want to leave the situation. After being shouted at a few more times, he turned and struggled towards the hospital. Craig said he was unable to talk. He had an extremely large laceration from one side of the jugular to the other. This was a true testament to the type of man that Eric was. With his life hanging in the balance, he was still worried about the others and still wanted to honour his role as a police officer. Paramedic Patricia St. Denis next took to the stand. As her voice quivered with emotion, she recollected how once Eric was on his feet, he mouthed the words, "Thank you," to the paramedics. Justice Douglas Rutherford was so moved by the paramedics' testimony that he said, "Your instincts were well placed. Commendable." Anna would later say that she found great comfort in knowing that Eric's last moments on Earth were spent with people who tried so desperately to help him and risk their own lives in doing so.
I know that Eric was surrounded by amazing people in the last moments of his life, and people who tried to save him, people who tried to save his life, and now people who are trying to bring justice. I appreciate, I'm amazed what they did. I don't think I would be able to do it myself.
Dr. Christopher Milroy took to the witness stand to take the jury through the wounds that Eric had sustained. As graphic photographs of Eric flashed up on the screen, many of his loved ones concealed their faces, unable to see the man they loved in such a distressing state. Dr. Milroy described how one knife wound went right through Eric's right cheek and pierced the other side. The wound that ended Eric's life had gone from one side of his neck to the other. The court also heard from Dr. Guy Herbert, the emergency physician on duty that night. He took the jury through the last hour of Eric's life as medical staff desperately attempted to save his life, knowing all too well that his survival rate from such an injury was around 5% at best. Dr. Herbert described how he received a panicked call alerting him to room number one. Before even arriving at the door, he was met by a trail of blood. When he entered the room, he saw Eric on the hospital bed. He said, "It was immediately obvious Officer Chapnick was losing consciousness right at that moment. Sort of a blank stare. His vital signs were diminishing, and he no longer was breathing. Vital signs absent. Blood just pouring out, spurting out." Over the course of the next hour, medical staff tried everything possible to bring life back to Eric. He lost his entire blood volume, not only once, but twice. He was losing it much quicker than the medical staff could replenish it. He said, "For all intents and purposes, he's died. were trying to revive him. At 5:26 a.m., Eric was pronounced dead. As Eric's life was ending in one hospital room, Kevin was in another hospital room, having self-inflicted wounds that he had inflicted the day before, being checked out. In a really sad twist of fate, after Dr. Herbert had failed to save the life of Eric, he was called in to assist with providing aid to Kevin. After being treated, Kevin was transported to the police station where he was placed in a cell. He requested food and a heater before requesting a 52-inch plasma television. Constable Greg Thompson told the courtroom that he was horrified by Kevin's behaviour. Kevin told Constable Thomas, "I came here looking for a fight. You city cops are tough." He then asked the constable whether the murder had hit the news yet and whether he would be getting a psychological exam and what the maximum sentence was for manslaughter. While by this point in the case, the media had already reported on Kevin's 2006 outburst at the Church of Jesus Christ of the Latter-day Saints. But testimony would be presented to show that Kevin's anger had been bubbling for much longer. Gary Jay, the Chief Superintendent of Human Resources for the RCMP, took the jury through Kevin's career at the police force, most of which had been marred by violence and personality issues. In January of 2001, Kevin had been accused of using excessive force in relation to a prisoner. According to the Chief Superintendent, this was a turning point in his career, and he spiraled out of control. In 2009, Kevin had lost his job after the RCMP determined that he was irrational and could not be trusted. There was a brief mention of the child sex abuse charge when Kevin's ex-wife took to the stand. Judge Douglas Rutherford cautioned the jury and said that the alleged rape is part of the narrative but should not be taken as fact because Kevin had not stood trial for the charges yet. Just the day before Eric's murder, she had accused Kevin of raping a 10-year-old girl. When she confronted him, Kevin denied it and stated, I'm done here. The RCMP are going to jump on this, regardless of the truth. While Kevin had already lost his job at the RCMP, he had often told people that he was going to get his job back. As it would later be revealed, Kevin's semen was found in relation to the rape, but he would claim that the police had planted it. During the second week of the trial, a videotaped interview between Kevin and Detective Tim Hodgins was played out, which had been conducted shortly after the murder. In the interview, Kevin claimed that he had attempted to end his own life. He stated, "I'm supposed to be dead. I can't friggin' die. I cut my throat. I have training in knives." Kevin claimed that he knew what to do with a knife, but said that it didn't work.
Please. Your intention this evening was to take your own life.
Yeah, I tried to commit suicide, and it didn't work. And I'm trained to take life. That's my specialization, and I can't believe the stupid knife.
Well, you continue to say your specialization. You didn't learn that as a police officer.
Yeah, I did.
Because I've never learned that. I've been a police officer longer than you.
They're not like us. We're the Mounties. So I just have holes in my head. And he said, because of that, he said, technically, I shouldn't be walking or talking right now. I should be dead. And he says, just that I'm just tough. I'm physically fit. So, mm-hmm. And even with these cutting my throat, I got in there good and deep. I was working it. And the doctor said that the arteries not, they move around.
Well, I think that's a natural reflex for them to try to move out of the way.
But I got in there good. I was like zigzagging it, and it just still didn't work. Damn it. Oh, well. Maybe a train will do it.
Well, I can be very honest with you, Kevin. If you ever...
get out of here, yeah, well, so I can get on the train.
That's if.
If.
I don't care. You're facing...
pen time?
Kevin, you're facing first-degree murder. The punishment for first-degree murder is life in jail.
Mm-hmm. Well, if that's what's going to happen, that's what's going to happen then.
When you hurt yourself, or when you cut your neck the first time, you said you did it three times today?
Oh, I did six. I did three on one side. I just dug it in.
Yeah.
Nope. because it's supposed to work.
But did you have it bandaged up when you went to the hospital?
Yeah, because I was bleeding everywhere. It was
so disgusting. Where'd you get the bandaging?
At my house.
Oh, okay.
I just got some band-aids, put them on it.
Okay.
So, and then I put another on top of it, because like, I'd get dressed and then all of a sudden down my front and be like, gross.
Kevin claimed that when his first suicide attempt failed, he decided to seek out a police officer so that he could steal his gun and end his own life.
My intent was to die tonight, and because I cut my throat and it didn't work, I needed a gun so I could blow my brains out. And I need, the only people who have guns are police officers. And so I went down to the hospital, because the hospitals always have policemen there. And that's it. I wanted his gun. I wanted to die. That's all. I still want to die.
You're a young man, Kevin. You have a ton of things going for you.
No, I don't.
Not you have a beautiful wife.
She's going to leave me for this. I'm not stupid. I know my wife. She's going to be gone after this.
You'll always have a son. You're always a father. Do you have any other children?
Yeah, a couple more.
While Kevin had claimed that he wanted the gun to end his own life, that didn't really match up with the evidence. For example, if he had simply wanted to kill himself, why was he wearing two bulletproof vests? When asked if he had remorse about killing Eric, he said that he did, but said that there was nothing he could do about it.
Do you feel sorry? What happened?
Oh, absolutely. There's nothing I can do. Nothing can be done. Like you said, you can't take back.
Well, there is. You could say sorry.
Are you? Well, to who?
Somebody will be watching this someday.
Yeah, I know. They're not gonna... His kids. Oh my gosh, he has kids.
How do you know?
Because Thompson told me. No, some other guy. He says, you sack of shit. He has two kids. No, sorry. The story doesn't cut it. So,
it's not. Might. You might want to try it. No?
Oh, no, no. I'm not saying no. Hey, down the road, if I run into his kids, if they come to me, and they, I'll talk to them and I'll tell them I'm sorry.
Well, with all due respect, Kevin, I don't think they want to talk to you.
Yeah, that's good. I wouldn't want to talk to me either.
Later on in the interview, Kevin blatantly stated that his defense would be the Mental Health Act. He told Detective Hodgins, "You do understand that this will be my defense. This whole thing is the Mental Health Act. It's written all over it, because I'm messed up." He further told the officer that he believed that he was suffering from depression and had suicidal thoughts for the past 5 years.
Do you think you're a fair person?
I was. I'm not anymore.
Why?
I'm a monster now.
Because of this?
Oh, yeah.
Or before?
Oh, because of this.
Do you think it's unjustified, that label? I mean, it's the label you've given yourself. Do you think it's accurate?
Oh, I was thinking about that today, because I told my dad that I'm a monster. And the thing is that humans are monsters.
Yeah, but if you told your dad that, that would be before you murdered the officer. So,
murdered.
Well, you murdered him.
The courts will decide that.
The interview went on for over 3 hours, and as Detective Hodgins said, Kevin spoke about a variety of things, from religion to health and heaven and hell, but said that the main focus was on himself. Kevin spoke mostly about himself. He made several contradictory statements during the interview, first of all stating, "I didn't murder the officer," before acknowledging that he had killed him. Midway through the interview, Detective Hodgins left the interview room to go to the bathroom, leaving Kevin alone with his thoughts.
Oh gosh, what a mess. Ugh. What a mess. Oh, damn. What a mess, what a mess, what a mess. Gosh, I'm getting in trouble, I'm getting in trouble. Damn.
Kevin was a member of the Church of Jesus Christ of the Latter-day Saints and acknowledged that he would be punished by God for his actions, stating that you cannot be forgiven if you take a life. At one point in the interview, Kevin referred to himself as evil and called himself a monster, before reiterating that all he wanted from Eric was his gun.
Don't be upset with me. I have to ask you something. What was his name?
His name? It was, Eric.
Eric. Okay.
His badge number was 1907. He's got two small children.
Yes. I know.
No, actually, he has four children. He has a wife. Like you. Like me.
Yep.
And you chose. Not him. You left him with no options. You made that choice. He was there at the hospital helping somebody. A victim of another violent crime.
Mm-hmm.
And you intervened with your selfish act. What say you to that? I want to know why you think that you could take another cop's gun and get away with it. Why you think that he'd let you take that gun? Why you think that he wouldn't fight for his life? Why would you think that? You wouldn't do it. I wouldn't do it. Why would you think he would? Because he wanted to help you? No. We very much knew the likely outcome of your choice. You knew the outcome of your choice. You knew that he would struggle for his life to keep his gun.
No. No, I didn't. I didn't think about it. I didn't think about a lot of things. I just focused on my own desire to die.
At one point, when Detective Hodgins left the interview room, he told Kevin that the camera was still running and told him that he should take the opportunity to send a message to Eric's family.
Kevin, there's a camera right there.
Yes.
Look at that camera. If there's one thing that you want to leave this room to tell Eric's family, it's right there.
I'm sorry with your dad.
That's it? You're not sorry about his brothers and sisters, his wife.
I never said it was eloquent.
That's all you got?
I'm not you. That's what I am. I am sorry. I'm really sorry. Eric's family. Yeah. I really had my head on my ass.
Following the interview, the courtroom fell deathly silent as a CCTV video was played out. The CCTV camera was inside the emergency room and had captured the moment that Eric staggered in. His jacket was saturated in blood and he was holding tightly to his neck. A paramedic led the way. The video was a vivid display of the horror that had unfolded that night, which would end with Eric's death. Minutes later, Kevin appears on screen, handcuffed and being led by police officers. He was taken to a separate room to be treated for his injuries. The injuries that Kevin had sustained were extremely minor, especially in comparison to Eric's. As mentioned earlier in this episode, Kevin had a shunt in his brain. Dr. Michael Kingstone, who had a speciality in neuroradiology, was next to take the witness stand. He testified that Kevin didn't have cysts on the brain like Kevin had claimed, but instead had something called atypical type 3 perivascular spaces on the brain. He described how when there's a buildup of fluid, it's because it isn't draining properly. Dr. Kingstone said that the shunt solved the problem of the fluid buildup, and looking at an image of Kevin's brain on the day of the stabbing, he said that the shunt was in working order, explaining that if it wasn't working, dark spots on the brain image would have been enlarged. His testimony was followed by Dr. John Sinclair, a neurosurgeon who had treated Kevin since 2008. He said that while Kevin had blamed his behaviour on his brain issues would not change somebody's personality or make them more aggressive. He said, the symptoms, depending on the speed of the blockage, could be a relatively slow onset of headaches, nausea, and drowsiness. He said that this would not cause increased aggression, stating, "It's not an area associated with personality behavior. Essentially, the chances of that are pretty close to zero." Following this testimony, the prosecution rested their case. It was now up to the defense to try and argue their case. The first witness they heard from was Kevin himself. Just like on the videotape, Kevin claimed that he had gone to the hospital to find a gun to kill himself. The packed courtroom fell silent as he said, "I didn't do it intentionally. It was a reaction. I'm trained up to the wazoo. I just reacted. He punched me, and I just reacted somehow. It was just habit, my training. I didn't do it intentionally. I did it, but I didn't do it." He said that he approached the window of Eric's car and ordered him to get out. He had been brandishing a BB gun but held it far back enough so that Eric wouldn't realize that it was fake. He claimed that Eric fell backwards and tried to grab his gun, so he decided to fight him for it. He said that Eric then punched him in the face. He said, "I didn't decide to pull the knife. It just came out. This is just my opinion. The stuff I learned was supposed to be for good, but I am lethal and effective. I didn't do it intentionally. I just reacted. It was fast. And as he said the final statement, he demonstrated two quick movements with his hands. Kevin's claims made absolutely no sense. If he had wanted the gun to end his own life, why was he wearing two bulletproof vests? Why was he carrying two knives? And why did he fight Eric for the gun when Eric reached for the gun? He very likely could have committed suicide by cop." He told the jury that he should have only been charged with manslaughter and went on to make disparaging remarks about himself, the RCMP, and even the paramedics. The only time he showed any semblance of emotion was when he spoke about his mother. Most of his testimony was exceptionally cold, and at one point, he even referred to the murder of Eric as the thing with Eric. Under cross-examination, Crown Attorney Brian Holoka dismissed Kevin's claims that he had acted instinctively when reaching for his knife. He instead argued that Kevin had gone to the emergency room looking for a police officer to kill. He said that if Kevin did order Eric out of the car with a BB gun, then Eric would have had more than enough time to press the emergency button, which was located in the police car. He argued that Kevin had taken Eric by surprise, and Kevin responded by saying, "I tried to kill myself. That's the Mental Health Act. That's definitely an indication of some kind of mental health issue." Crown Attorney Holoka went over the fact that Kevin had said numerous times that he was good at violence and that use of force was his instinct. Kevin responded by accusing him of grasping at straws and even accused him of harassing him. The Crown put forward the theory that in December of 2009, Kevin's world was crumbling down around him. He had lost his career with RCMP. He had $30 to his name. His wife was leaving him, and he had been accused of raping a child. Crown Attorney Holoka said, "It was the end of the line for you. When the sexual assault comes up, you truly well knew you would never come back from that." He additionally revealed that while Kevin was claiming to be suicidal, while being interviewed by police, he seemed extremely keen on what kind of publicity the case was generating, and even said that he wanted to get out of jail so that he could get back into the RCMP as a civilian and buy a fancy new car. When Crown Attorney Holoka put forward that this doesn't indicate a suicidal man, Kevin replied with, "I'm brain damaged. I don't remember." While Kevin had been adamant that issues with his brain had caused the violence within him, the defense presented no evidence of such. In fact, they presented no evidence whatsoever, and the only testimony had come from Kevin himself. During closing arguments, defense attorney Fleming described his client as an obnoxious and insensitive killer, but said that he was not guilty of murder. Instead, he suggested that Kevin was guilty of manslaughter because he lacked intent. During the Crown's closing arguments, they refuted this, stating that Kevin often bragged about how skilled he was with knives and how much harm he could inflict with them. Crown Attorney Holoka said that when he unleashed his attack on Eric, he knew exactly what he was doing. Speaking to the jury, he said, "I'm asking you to ignore speculation and support findings of guilt in first-degree murder." He reminded the jury of the severity of Eric's injuries and said that there was no way for those to be done without intent or done as a mere reaction. With all of the evidence presented, it was now up to the jury to reach a verdict. Unsurprisingly, it didn't take them long. They found Kevin Gregson guilty of first-degree murder. Following the verdict, many in the courtroom began to weep. It had been an emotional and disturbing trial, especially with the graphic photographs of Eric. Following the verdict, Eric's loved ones had their chance to speak during impact statements. His son, Arthur, asked the courtroom for a minute of silence to honour his father. Turning to Kevin, Arthur said that he was studying to become a police officer and follow in his father's footsteps. He said, "Gregson, because of people like you, I need to be a police officer to help our community, to put away people like you." Constable Chris Goetz, who had worked alongside Eric, also directed his statement at Kevin, stating, "Your narcissistic, bloating self-image is appalling. Your unwavering lack of remorse is something I will never understand or forgive. You destroyed a family. You murdered a friend, a husband, a father, a hero." Paramedic Virginia Warner spoke on behalf of the four paramedics who rushed to Eric's aid. She said that having somebody die right in front of her had left an unimaginable impact. Then it was Anna's turn to speak. She described how their five-year-old son, Anthony, missed his father every single day and was always asking when he would come home. Kevin was sentenced to life in prison with no eligibility for parole for 25 years. When asked if he wanted to say anything, Kevin said no. In September, Kevin was in court once again for the child sex abuse charge. In an absolutely heartbreaking video, the 10-year-old victim recounted how Kevin had raped her several times in the week before he murdered Eric. "I won't go into detail, but at one point in the video, the little girl said that Kevin told her that he had more power than her and he was going to rape her again, and there was nothing she could do about it." The little girl said that Kevin had left her with such traumatic injuries that it was painful for her to walk. Kevin's father, Reed Gregson, testified that the day before Eric's murder, Kevin had arrived at his house and told him that he had done something pretty stupid and that if he were convicted, he would be facing 10 years in prison. He testified, "As he stood at the door, he said, 'I'm a bad guy. I'm just a monster and I've done very bad things.'" Reed said that he believed his son was talking about things he had done as a police officer. During the trial, it was confirmed that the little girl's blood and a mix of her and Kevin's DNA was discovered on a mattress. The stain with Kevin's DNA was not blood, but could not be conclusively identified. Several doctors also testified in regards to the injuries that the little girl had sustained. Without going into detail, they were horrific. While Eric had a lot to say during his murder trial, he decided against testifying during the child sexual abuse trial. However, his defense lawyer suggested that the victim had multiple opportunities to practice her story, which could be an invention. This was rebutted by Prosecutor Holoka, who said that the little girl showed exceptional bravery and was unshaken during cross-examination. Furthermore, the evidence against Kevin was overwhelming. Kevin Gregson was found guilty on four counts of sexual assault causing bodily harm. He was sentenced to 10 years in prison, which would run concurrently with the life sentence he was already serving. The little girl had filed an impact statement, which was read aloud by a police officer who held the little girl in his arms. In a moment of true bravery, the little girl offered Kevin forgiveness, but only if he apologized. When given the chance to speak, Kevin shrugged and mumbled sure. He stood up and said, "I didn't kill Eric Chapnick. I didn't murder him. I dreamed when I was 20 that this was going to happen to me." Afterwards, he was led out of the courtroom. He offered no apology.
You know what? One thing that I find myself repeatedly saying to Anthony about Eric is that he's watching over us. That in a sense, we're lucky. Anthony often refers to not having a father and losing a father in his childhood. In his early childhood, he was 3 years old when it happened. He misses him. He goes to hockey practices. There are mostly fathers there, and then it's me. He misses that dad cannot see his accomplishments in hockey and soccer. I always tell him how proud Eric would have been of Anthony, and also that he watches him, and we're, in a sense, lucky. We have an angel over us. The only thing that I can say about his passing is that if this was his path, and this is how his life was supposed to end, short of being 52, just at 51-year-old with a 3-year-old, little boy at home, I guess dying as a police officer, it was his calling. You know what? If it had to happen, I'm glad it happened that I became a part of the family in blue. He experienced it in his life, and he fulfilled his dream.
The senseless murder of Eric Chapnick changed everything for Ottawa police officers as well as Ottawa paramedics. While paramedics deal with tragedies on a day-to-day basis, they were thrust into the middle of a crime scene and tried everything in their power to prevent bloodshed. It's now been over a decade since Eric was murdered, but even still, his legacy lives on, both in the heart of his family as well as in the heart of his fellow police officers. As his wife, Anna, said on the 10-year anniversary, "When he became a police officer, that was something. It was something for a person who is born here. It's an honour, and it should be. It's that much harder when you're not born here. And I think that he was really content in his life when he passed away." Well, guys, that is it for this episode of Morbidology. As always, thank you so much for listening. I already said it at the start of this episode, but once again, thank you so much to my Patreon supporters. The support on there truly helps me defray the costs of freedom of information requests, archive subscriptions, hosting, and much more. So if you'd like to support the show in return for exclusive episodes of Morbidology Plus, ad-free episodes, early release episodes, true crime articles, polls, and much, much more, please check out Morbidology on Patreon. The link is in the description. Can I also ask that if you enjoy Morbidology, please consider leaving me a 5-star rating or review on Apple Podcasts or wherever else you're listening. Reviews are an easy way to support a podcast that you like. Big thank you to everybody who has simply listened to an episode, commented on an episode, shared an episode, sent me a message on social media. The support is very much appreciated. Also, make sure you visit me at morbidology.com for more information about this episode and to read some true crime articles. And stay tuned to the end of this episode to hear a promo for the amazing true crime podcast, Crimes and Consequences. Until next time, take care of yourselves, stay safe, and have an amazing week.
Hi everyone, I'm Talia.
And I'm Tanya.
And together we're two attorneys that really like to dive into the details of true crime cases, which is why we created Crimes and Consequences, our own true crime podcast. In our podcast, we really want to know the details of a case, so it's really important to us to try to get transcripts and audio or video recordings when we can. In addition, we don't really want to just rehash cases you've always heard. Of course, there's a place for the really famous cases, but it's also interesting to learn about true crime stories that you've never heard before. To give you just a little feel for how our podcast goes, here's a snippet from episode 34 called Closed Casket. Later on that same day at 3:08 p.m., the Smith residents received another phone call from the kidnapper. Here's part of that phone call.
4:58 a.m., Saturday the 1st of June.
Okay, Saturday the 1st of June.
Became one soul.
What does that mean?
No questions now, please.
Do not kill my daughter, please. Please.
Love and miss y'all.
So if you're like Tanya and I and you want to know the gritty details of the true crime case, listen to Crimes and Consequences, a hardcore true crime podcast.